Dealt with the Relaxed Back UK show on UK Health Radio, your global real feel-good radio station. On the Relaxed Back UK show, we explore all kinds of health topics, so keep listening and enjoy the ride.
Hi, and thank you for joining me on the Relaxed Back UK show. Show today is a hopeful and positive message to start the new year. Julian Morgan's life has been run by his need for alcohol for years. However, he's managed to break free from that and is all the happier for it.
Stick to it and you will have daily sobriety. And right. I am one happy chappy.
He tells the story of just how bad he was and, more importantly, how he managed to get better and also write a book to help others.
The station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Julian Morgan is a recovered alcoholic. He's written a book called Surrender. So first off, I asked him what it was all about.
Yeah, hi, Mike. Firstly, thanks very much indeed for having me on your show today.
You're very welcome.
I think the apt word is grateful, and gratitude does come into the journal a lot when people hopefully will be reading it. It is an essential part of addiction recovery. And that is what my book is all about. It is all about my journey from being a chronic alcoholic, unfortunately, basically in the early 20s. Looking back, I definitely had issues from the age of about 10, funnily enough. And ultimately, through my schooling, I'm 56 years of age. So in those days, it wasn't recognized at all as a problem. In actual fact, if anybody said that, then you were ultimately the dregs of society, and you were classified the same as a rapist or some sort of paedophile, and so it was ultimately ignored. And so I then, through my teenage years, I was actually very good at sport, and I represented the county, the East of England. I had a national ranking as a junior at tennis. There was a possibility, I suppose, at the age of 14 to go to America and become professional. But my father didn't actually like that idea. He'd prefer me to stay at school and basically play first 15 rugby and tennis and things like that. So in actual fact, my upbringing has been pretty normal. Middle class family, two brothers, two sisters, very loving parents, no addiction issues at all with anybody through any of the generations, except possibly for an auntie, but that's a different ballgame. So basically what then happened was that I wasn't particularly academic, and I tried for the army to become an army officer. I cocked up RCB, the Regular Commissions Board, to get into Sandhurst. So I went in as a soldier for a very limited amount of time. And again, in those days, nobody recognised that I had a really, ultimately, a major issue with.
Is life as a soldier, or was life as a soldier then, quite a hard drinking life, or it could be?
I'd be totally honest, I wasn't in there for particularly long at all. The reason being is that part of my potential officer's course to get into Sandhurst was to become a sales manager in London. I had to just become a manager for any company in any industry, wherever. And a friend of mine was an exceptionally good photocopier salesman. And so I decided to go and have a look at that for a couple of weeks, went there, saw the money earning potential, and I thought, wow. So after the potential officer's course, after my basic training as a soldier, I was on an O-type engagement, which meant that I could come out basically whenever I wanted. So I hadn't actually signed up for a period of time. So I came out and went straight into photocopier sales. Now, prior to going into the military, they said that I was a little bit too young at the age of 17. So I went on a kibbutz in Israel and a mushaf just to get some independence, confidence.
I don't know what a mushaf is. I've heard of a kibbutz. What's a mushaf, Julian?
Yeah, a mushaf is more. A mushaf is more of a, should we say, a labour camp more than anything. You work for a farmer as opposed to a community, and you get paid in US dollars, and you make a lot more money on a. You actually earn a living on a mushaf as opposed to pocket money on a kibbutz, whereas the kibbutz actually provides everything for you, all your food, absolutely everything. And so those two I did. Now, very important point here, actually, Mike, on the mushaf and the kibbutz, that is also where I started to drink quite heavily, because it was just the norm to, when you finished a day's work, whether it be on the kibbutz or the mushaf, was to go into the local shop and get a bottle of spirit. And over there, it used to be the local vodka or a spirit called Arak. And so I used to drink a bottle of that. Anyway, that's another thing that's in the book where it all started and escalated from. So anyway, coming back from that, went to the army, cocked up my RCB, went into sales. In those days, it was the late 80s, early 90s, before the Thatcher recession came in. And so it was a license to print money. And it was the Champagne Charlie lifestyle, if you like to call it. Money was no object. You hit your sales targets. You had, and basically all, you know, I bought a flat and was mortgage free by the age of 21. In St. Albans, which is quite an affluent area.
Through selling photocopiers?
Yeah, selling photocopiers. And
so you must have been very good at it.
I must admit, I did quite well. The sales team that I was in, our sales team were the top photocopier sales team in London 7 years in a row. So we did well, and we got paid well, but we parted well.
Right.
So
let's explore this, because when we were chatting earlier, for a lot of the time you kind of described yourself as a functioning alcoholic. So, you know, you must have been functioning quite well to buy a flat by the age of 21, really, because no one's going to give you that.
Yes, exactly. Functioning alcoholic is actually quite important, because a lot of people would classify themselves as heavy drinkers, heavy boozers, excuse the French, piss head, booze hound, as they would call it in the States. And so it was, again, as I say, I was like 21. So you're looking at... you know, the early 90s. And it just wasn't alcohol addiction, anything like that was not just wasn't taken seriously at all. It was everybody's finger pinpointed at the old stigma of the dirty old man on the bench with a brown paper bag and a bottle of the strongest spirits or wine you could possibly get. And they were the people, they sort of like, oh, turn their nose up against all that sort of stuff. But we were ultimately exactly the same. Except we didn't come across or appear like that. But mentally, we were, because the illness, I like to call it an illness as opposed to a disease. I think it's a mental illness. It's personal. It's my opinion. A lot of people will disagree, but a lot of people will agree. And basically, that illness was there already. And it was just a matter of it escalating.
Right.
But people couldn't see it because, of course, I had all the flash cars. I was going out all the nice clothes. You know, it was, it was an absolutely celebrity life, really, if you want to call it that. And then, as I say, the recession came in 91/92, and it was impossible to reach targets. So I decided to jump ship and tick off a bucket list thing, which was to go and do some backpacking. So, because I had the itch after being on the kibbutz anyway. Now, was that itch because I enjoyed the drinking on the kibbutz, or was it because I actually, you know, seriously wanted to go traveling again? Now, I think possibly it was more that I could go over there, backpack for a year, and then drink to my heart's content. Yeah.
So is that what you did effectively? You went off on a bit of a
cruise around
Europe.
Absolutely that, because I knew I could get away with it, right? So, with all good intentions, and I did. I spent a couple of years in Australia, a year working on my tourist visa, and a year overstaying. And basically, after the 2 years, I think I got barred for 3 years or something. I don't know.
An alcoholic illegal in Australia.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, basically.
What happened then? So you came back to the UK.
Yeah. What happened then was that from New Zealand, from Australia, the natural progression was to go to New Zealand. And I went to New Zealand and I managed to get a couple of 3 year work permits. Okay, which basically meant 6 years, and then I overstayed for another couple of years there as well, which was eight. So my total stay in the Southern Hemisphere was 10 years. Now, my work was basically nightclub, bar, or wine bar management, which meant that I could drink to my heart's content free.
Yeah, this sounds like a pretty dangerous occupation for an alcoholic.
There in those days weren't owned. Exceptionally dangerous occupation. Exceptionally dangerous occupation. And basically what I was doing was that I was enabling myself all the time. So from basically not even possibly realizing it, but I was still from the age of about 18, I was enabling myself so that I could near enough at all times have drink available for me all the time. Yeah. Now, so where it comes to addiction and where it comes to alcoholism or drug addiction, it doesn't matter at all. Addiction, full stop. It will escalate, and it does escalate. And where it comes to, you were mentioned earlier on about
being a functioning alcoholic.
Functioning alcoholic. Yeah, a functioning alcoholic. You can be a functioning alcoholic, and a lot of people stay a functioning alcoholic for long periods of time. You can actually, you know, sometimes decades. But then what happens is that it does go that one step further, and I've seen this in so many people. They then will become dependent on it. And at the end of the day, unless you stop this increase of harm, basically, that you're doing to yourself and literally everybody that you associate with, you will become dependent. And then that's it. That is when your chips are up. That is when you have basically had it.
Right. So you were living your life doing all kinds of exciting things as a functioning alcoholic. At some point, you must have said to yourself, right, I need to change. Enough is enough. Did that happen quickly or did you slide into that? And when did that happen?
Basically, what happened there, Mike, was that I wanted to change. I knew I had an issue. I knew I had an issue when I was 21. I just did not realize how quickly and how seriously it would escalate from, you know, having the pint of lager to the glass of wine to the odd G&T to a straight gin to a bottle. And then ultimately at the end of my, as it were, heyday, I was on literally between a litre and 2 litres of spirits neat a day. And I am just probably the luckiest man on this planet to be alive. And that is what my GP told me.
But you can't have been a functioning alcoholic then. Did you have a job when you were drinking that much?
No, it wasn't. What happened then was that my life was just utter obliteration. I knew that I had a problem when I was 21, but I just did not know what to do about it. I had no idea at all. I wanted to give up. I thought to myself, right, let's go cold turkey. Oh, no way, Jose. You feel so ill. And also, I'll point this out, that the degree of severity of alcoholism, if your body is that dependent on it, alcohol withdrawal can be fatal. And not many people know that. I don't think you knew that, Mike, did you?
No, you mentioned that earlier. I was very surprised by that.
Yeah, exactly. It can be fatal. So basically, you are in this cycle of wanting to give up, not knowing how to give up. When you try, the likes of willpower or things such as that, which do not work, I can assure you, do not work. So any of your listeners think, oh, I could do it on willpower. You can't. And if you think you can do it on willpower and you have done it on willpower, I can assure you, you are not an alcoholic, mate. Go and do something else. Go on the bloody tennis court or whatever. But unfortunately, the escalation is miserable and you go into very deep, dark places. Exactly the same with drug addicts. They're in a cycle as well. With a drug addict though, when they have a fix, that won't last very long. So they've got to have one pretty damn quickly. Whereas alcohol, you can just top it up until you basically black out. And then you can start again the following day. You know, you might, because you've got so much alcohol in your system, you might be able to last until the following night. That's how a lot of people can get through the day working. And that's why they call themselves functioning alcoholics. But there will be a stage during the course of that day where they will start white knuckling. They will start looking at that clock thinking, Jesus Christ, when can I get home? When can I finish work? Because I do need to top that up because I am feeling light. Unfortunately, where it comes to drugs, that's basically where the term chasing the dragon comes from. Because they need fixes all the time so much quicker than you do where it comes to alcohol. But, it's a big but, I say this because you then can reach a level of your alcoholism where you have literally got to get up in the morning and pour a large gin over your cornflakes because your withdrawal is so bad. You know, you can't even pick up a teaspoon to put sugar in your tea. You know, you cannot do anything. You cannot think straight. Yeah. You just cannot do anything until you have alcohol in your system to make you feel normal. Also, what happens is that when you do have, and everybody does it, everybody in addiction is exactly the same. You know, you will have so much shame and guilt. You will have so much anxiety, a paranoia, the feeling of worthlessness, the feeling of harm and what you've done to other people. And it's absolutely dreadful. But you can't do anything about it. You just cannot do anything about it.
So, Julius, let me just interrupt here. Let's kind of rewind. You're saying you can't do anything about it, but you must have done, because you're talking to me now and you haven't had a drink for years. So how did you get out of that spiral?
Exactly. What happened was that I, looking back, also didn't want to do anything about it either, because I enjoyed initially the drinking and the mood it put me in, but then I didn't enjoy my character and what people then saw me. They saw, no, this isn't Julian, this is, oh my God, who is this man? And so ultimately I thought, right, rehab. Okay. And I thought, right, I can do that. And luckily, I managed to have, in those days, I went to my first rehab in 2004, which is a place down in Boscombe in Bournemouth. And it was government funded. So I went there, very lucky. I don't think it's around now, unfortunately. There aren't many government funded places in the UK, I understand. But I think they are trying to improve that situation. The current government have recognised it and they are trying to improve it. So hats off to them if this does actually happen. So anyway, went there 6 months. I went there and I thought, woohoo, 6 months off the booze, no problem at all. I'll come out totally new man. Great stuff. Let's start from fresh. But I went in there with the intention not to give up the booze. I went in there with the intention to come out and try and control it. Now, this is a massive, massive thing. You cannot control addiction. You can't control it. So, of course, I came out once again. I thought, right, I've done 6 months, straight away, down the pub, have a drink. Now, that one drink on a Monday, I can assure you, by the Friday, you'll be back on drinking top shelf, drinking your straight gin chasers with five pints of Stella. And then another couple of weeks down the line, you'll be back straight into rehab again. And that is why these rehabs are so profitable, because it is just like a conveyor belt of people going in, getting sober, with the medication they take, like detox, like Librium, where it comes to heroin, methadone or whatever. They just go straight back out again and do it all over again and straight back into rehab. Now,
so you got off the conveyor belt and got on with life and wrote your book. So give us kind of a potted version of how you managed
exactly.
That.
Yeah, basically, this took me 20 years. So 20 years of denial, of saying I could control it, relapsing. And by the way, every single relapse you do is worse than the last one. I can assure your listeners, and the ones that are listening to this who are in recovery will be able to relate to this. A relapse is worse than the last one. It escalates. Anyway, on my eighth rehab, and this was just under 6 years ago now. So I'm coming up to 6 years sober. And it was Christmas Eve, and I decided to check myself into a rehab on Christmas Eve. And it was in Watford, just down the road from me, in St Albans. Jumped in a taxi. On the way to the rehab, I said to the taxi driver, can you stop off at this garage, please, because I want to buy some cigarettes for the rehab. And I got out of the taxi to go into the garage, tripped on the step, broke my ankle, and the taxi then took me to Watford General Hospital. And on Christmas Eve, I was in Watford General Hospital until they couldn't operate until New Year's Day because my leg was so swollen. And I spent the whole of that 2 weeks in that ward on my own. Unfortunately, my relationship with family and friends was at rock bottom because of the mental strain that I had put them under for so many years. You see, what you've got to remember is that people can forget what you do. People can forget what you have said, but people will never forget how you made them feel. Yeah. And so everybody that I knew were ultimately really, really hurt. So I didn't see anybody for the whole of that fortnight.
So Julian, after you've been like on your own in hospital over Christmas with a broken foot brought on by staggering around because you were drunk, did you then go to the rehab?
Yes, I did. I did. And to be totally honest, Mike, what happened was that hospital for a week, as I say, between Christmas Eve and New Year's Day, I without a doubt, was the worst week of my entire life. I had hit rock bottom, and that is when I basically cried out for help. That is when I found my spirituality and my higher powers. And you will not find that. You will not find those higher powers or your own spirituality until you reach that particular stage where you have just had enough. And rather just going into loads of detail now, because I could speak to you for a week about this, Mike, about spirituality and higher powers and things like that, I'll just leave it for the readers to possibly do their own research or read the book, look at my explanation, because it might take a long time, but if you are desperate enough and you have had enough, you have hit rock bottom and you finally have the desire to stop drinking or stop taking drugs, you will find spirituality. You will find higher powers. And those higher powers guide me literally on a daily basis. And they keep me sober and they keep me in sobriety.
All right. Let me ask you. Let me ask you a bit about that, because that must be a very important thing. Wherever the sort of the strength or the guide comes for it. People that are alcoholics but don't drink anymore, I can imagine them having to set up a kind of a daily plan or a way of living such that they're not tempted or alcohol doesn't come their way. Is that something that you've battled with, and is that something you've written about in your book?
It is exactly what I've written about in my book, Mike. Basically, the first half of the book is that final journey through that rehab. and how I found spirituality and how I found my higher powers. And then the second half of the book is how I live on a daily basis and how I stay recovered on a daily basis. Today I am recovered. I don't know what I'll be like tomorrow, but today I am recovered. So some people will call me a recovering alcoholic. Some people will call me a recovered alcoholic. But the point is, today I am recovered. And the way I go around that is that I have a set of tasks that I do daily. And these are all itemized in the book. They are explained. They are, I've given examples.
Yeah, give us an example or two, Julian.
Right, okay. Excuse me. So basically what happens is that my daily routine starts off with, now people are going to think, oh no, religion, but it's not religion. I start off with prayer and meditation in the morning. Now I just have a chat, and that chat is to my higher powers first thing in the morning, just to guide me through the day, anything that's on my mind, any problems, any struggles, any anything that I feel as though I need ironed out, just so that I can feel safe. I will confront my higher powers with any of those issues first thing in the morning, and I do get them solved. Now, that's that part done. The second part of the day, during the course of the day, I always make a gratitude list. I always have a small pen and paper around, and I write little gratitudes down wherever I go. And I make a list of 10 gratitudes every day. Gratitude, basically, if you're grateful for something, it puts a smile on your face. It makes you joyful. It makes you happy. Yeah. The whole idea of that is to turn around negative thinking into positive thinking. As soon as you have negative thinking, then you start going down the doom and gloom again. You've got to stay positive. And so writing a gratitude list every day is absolutely imperative.
Right. So, Julian, I know recovering alcoholics, or, you know, people that have had trouble with drink, they talk about triggers and things that they have to kind of keep themselves away from, so that they, you know, they don't regress into their old habits. Have you got triggers that are specific to you? And do you talk about triggers in the book as well?
Yes, I have. Yeah, I have, Mike. Triggers are actually so important. They are what we call the red alert areas. Ultimately, when you are in early recovery, part of organizing your daily plan is to work out your own personal trigger list. Now, that trigger list can be obviously bars, restaurants, nightclubs, certain people, all sorts. There are loads. Again, it's all in the book, and it states exactly how to pinpoint, how to look at triggers. Because you can't turn around and say, oh, well, I might have drunk in that situation, or I might have used a drug in that. You know, no, it doesn't work like that. You know, would you or would you have not? And if you have the slightest doubt, bang, that is a trigger. You've got to have those worked out before you start your daily recovery, before you start. But you will work all this out anyway in a rehab or with a counsellor or with any help, or even reading my book. You can work it out yourself from reading my book. Now,
what one thing that I just want to ask about, you, we were talking about it before we were recording. You mentioned holidays.
Yes, that's right.
Tell us about that.
That is a trigger, Mike, for so many people. Absolutely. What happens is that. What happens with that when you're in addiction, you are permanently trying to enable yourself to have a drink and get away with it. Yeah. And what you do is you convince yourself that a change of location, you can go there, whether it be a town just around the corner, or whether it be a long haul flight to the other side of the world, when you return back to where you live, you're going to start all over again, clean slate, not drink. Yeah. So, of course, holidays, you think, right, I'm going to go for a 2-week holiday. I'm going to go, hell for leather in the bars, restaurants, have a great old shindig, knees up, all that sort of stuff. And when I just touch back at Luton Airport, then, right, I'm not going to touch a drop ever again. Yeah, it does not work like that. It just, you can't do it. You cannot do it. And then what happens is that you get back to Luton Airport on the Monday morning, and by the following Sunday night, you are basically in absolute shite order.
Once back again, to square one.
All over again. Yeah, it does not work. So things like that, location, environment, association. They are all triggers, and you've just got to work them out. And as I say, there is quite a straightforward way of doing that, again written in the book for people to understand. It's not difficult. Now, very importantly, my main trigger, which still is actually it's worth mentioning this very briefly, is that my main trigger is has always been relationships. When I split up with somebody, generally through booze, I try and suppress all my feelings, cottonwood all my feelings by the booze, by using that as a mask, you know. And what happens with alcohol, full stop, it enhances those deep, dark, depressive feelings. It takes you down further and further and further. And of course, the only way of making you feel any better is to drink more, right? So I know for a fact relationships are a no-no for me. So, but what I do now, considering I've had quite a few years of sobriety, is that I still don't go into relationships. What I do is I actually participate, should we say, in the swinger community. Now, in a nutshell, swingers are a set of people that are very liberated. They are they have the same mindset as you. It is all about no strings attached, NSA relationships. So there is no commitment. And it might be couples, it might be singles, it might be three people, it might be five people. They have swinger clubs, swinger parties. There are swinger sites on the web where you can you can meet the same like-minded people. But the point is, there is no commitment. There is no relationship. You can have feelings, but there's no relationship. And that works for me because like any human being, you have your natural needs, and I can get my natural needs through this situation without any commitment, and it works. So again, it's all about trying to work these things out. And when you gradually progress through the second half of the book, it will point these out. I've written all sorts of other poems as well. I think I sent you a poem, Mike. Do you read my poem?
No, I have to admit, I haven't read the poem.
Right, yeah.
Sorry about that, Julian.
No, that's okay. I've actually done 12 poems as well. The reason I did that was because it puts another dimension to the book. It makes it some people might find the poems easier to understand than what I actually wrote. It reinforces also some of the stuff. So I've basically done a poem on higher power. I've done a poem on AA and the fellowship. I've done a poem on relationships. I've done a poem on the likes of denial. There's 12.
Let's park that so people can go and explore that if they want to, via reading your book. Let me ask you about something which is advice, really, and because you've kind of lived through all of this. If someone has a friend or a family member that they're frankly somewhat concerned about. They think they might be drinking too much. You know, they could be a functioning alcoholic or whatever the situation is. Actually, broaching the subject with them, I imagine, could be extremely difficult. Well, have you got any advice for this? And I'm sure a lot of people are in this situation. What can you actually do if you're worried about someone?
There's going to be, you've just basically hit the nail on the head there. There is going to be loads of people listening to this particular show, Mike, and they will know. As a natural fact, if you look at the whole population, really, I mean, I'm not exaggerating here. If you look at the whole population, every single person will know somebody, whether it be family, whether it be a friend, whether it be a friend of a friend, whether it be an association of someone at work or whatever, they will know somebody who has got an addiction issue. Yeah, they will. Now, it's a difficult one because you can't approach them. You cannot approach them, especially if they are in denial, because it will come back in your face like a meteorite. Yeah, it really will. And it will upset them. Anybody came to me in my heyday and said, oh, don't you think you're drinking a bit too much there, Julian? And I say, I'm not drinking too much. Why don't you go and F off, you know, mind your own business, you know, because you think it's all, or you always think it's the others. You don't think it's you. It's always the others. It's always the others ganging up on you. It's all the others that have got the problem. You haven't got the problem. Yeah. In an ideal world, you have to wait until that person comes up and says, Mike, can I have a quick word with you, mate? And I've got a bit of I think I've got an issue here. Look, can I just possibly have your feelings on it? What do you think about it? But you know, that is, you know, as rare as what you can possibly get, because people who have got issues and don't want to admit they have issues will not listen to anybody. And by actually approaching them and saying, look, I think you need to go and sort yourself out, they know that anyway. They know that anyway. And all it will do was get on their nerves, and it will just cause huge, massive animosity. It really will. So it's difficult. It's difficult. Now, especially with friends. Family, that's how you get family rifts. I have spent years making amends to my family, and luckily, I think I'm okay now. But it took me a long time. You will make amends with friends and family, but it does take time. It is not a short process, I can assure you. It is.
So it's difficult to approach. Maybe you could.
It is difficult. The only way.
Buy them your
the
book.
Only way you can. The only way you can do that is really after. Any way of really doing that is ultimately on a health situation, saying, look, you know, you are going so badly downhill, you know, you have got to see somebody, otherwise you are not going to be alive in 6 months' time. That is one way of doing it. But then again, though, I got told on numerous occasions, look, if you don't give up, you will be dead. So what? You know, let me have a drink and I'll just forget about what you just said. You know, it's the whole same game. You know, if something you don't like, you hear something that you don't like, you just drink to forget about it. Yeah. So ultimately, it is down to that person wanting to do it. You can obviously say it. And the more people say, I mean, you know, Mike, every single family member, everyone, even my nephews and nieces, turned around and said, God, bloody hell, I don't like being around Uncle Julian at the moment because, you know, he's drunk again, you know. All my friends, oh, God, you know, are we going out with Julian? Oh, Jesus Christ, we've got to carry him home. You know, oh, my God, we've got to pick him up off the pavement. You know, and it just doesn't matter because you are so, taken with this insidious illness. You are oblivious, really. For people trying to help, you don't think they're trying to help. You just think that all they're doing is trying to pry into your life.
Right.
It's insanity. It's insanity, Mike. And that's the unfortunate thing about addiction. It is insanity because you are powerless over it. You are like a puppet.
All right. We're going to have to. So I guess you're just going to have to do what you can do when you can, if you're worried about someone. Look, I think, yeah. Julian,
it's a window of opportunity. I tell you what, Mike, I'll leave it on this one, on that particular subject. It's just got to be a window of opportunity, and you've got to spot that window of opportunity. And if you think there's one there, go for it.
Grab it
and see what happens. But I'm being honest. I'm just being totally honest, and this honesty is coming from my own personal experiences.
Of course, you've been there. That's why I'm asking these questions. Final question. You've written your book. How can people get hold of it if they're thinking, right, I need to have a read of this? Where is it? Where can people get hold of your book?
Okay, it's on Amazon KDP. And the book is called Surrender. Underneath it, it says how to break free from addiction. And on the front cover is a picture of a phoenix. Actually, I sent you the cover, Mike. Did you get that?
Yeah, I got that.
Yeah. The picture of the phoenix, which is the symbol of rebirth. And of course, when you decide to stop drinking and have the desire to stop drinking or taking drugs, then you do have to change your life. And it is like being reborn.
Excellent.
And you have got basically a brand new life in front of you. You really have. And I must admit, I over the last 6 years, I've been so happy. I've been so happy. It's just, it's great. And I've got all my friends back. I've got all my family back. Is Uncle Julian coming? In the old days, you know, I wouldn't even get a Christmas card.
Right. Yeah. Excellent. So, Julian, it sounds like it's been a success for you. So, well done.
Yeah.
Keep it going. And thank you very much indeed for telling your story and giving us an insight on what it's like to go through this.
Mike, I can assure you, it is horrible. And unfortunately, people aren't aware of this, but so many millions of people are affected throughout the world. And it's just making people aware. And it's I'm doing my 12th step, Mike. I'm helping them out. Have a look at the book. It's a process that works for me. Hopefully it will work for them. And it is an easy process. Stick to it and you will have daily sobriety. And right. I am one happy chappy.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Thank you very much to my guest on this week's show. That was Julian Morgan, who's written a book called Surrender. And of course, a big thank you to you for listening.
That was the Relaxed Back UK Show with me, Mike Dill. Thank you for listening, and please do join us again next time.